In the mid-50s, two men knocked over a kerosene stove during a fight at a concert. After fleeing the blaze, the guitar player realized he left his beloved Gibson inside. B.B. King then ran in and saved it. He later learned that the fight was over a woman named Lucille, and ever since, his guitars have borne that name. You can find Lucille at the Hard Rock in Hollywood, Florida. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
Little Stevens Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
It's coolest conversations podcast time at Little Stevens Underground Garage, presented by Hard Rock. I'm the Mighty Manfred. Thanks for listening. Please remember to follow and subscribe, rate, and review. Today I've got the pleasure of speaking with Oliver Lieber of the Los Angeles-based band The Bayonets. He's the drummer and also the son of producer and songwriter Jerry Lieber of Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller fame. As you'll hear, Oliver's apple fell pretty close to the tree. The Bayonets' latest single is Argentina, out now on Wicked Cool Records. It's also a recent coolest song of the week. And I'll play a bit of it now, followed by my chat with Oliver on your Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock in Little Stevens Underground Garage. Got the Mighty Manfred with you as we begin today's coolest conversations, and with me is musician and producer Oliver Lieber. Like his famed father Jerry Lieber, Oliver has had a hand in writing and producing top 10 hits, and he joins us today to talk about his role in the LA-based band The Bayonets. We've got this week's coolest song in the world, Argentina, out now on Wicked Cool Records. How are you, Oliver?
I'm doing well, man. Nice to be on the phone with you.
Well, nice to speak with you again. Do you recall we spoke Christmas Day 2015?
Wow.
So you talked about your young daughters then. Are they teenagers now?
Man, I am raising a 14-year-old girl and a 17-year-old girl. And I'm a single dad. And nothing in my life has prepared me for what I'm dealing with.
It's so plenty of eye rolls,
man. It's all eye rolls and whatever, and doors closing in my face.
Oh, wow. So I was single dad and I just had one daughter.
Right.
And so the teenagers, of course, just as you're saying, challenging. But the first thing that really blew my mind about this, how completely from a different planet this was going to be, was when she was like 5 or 6. And, you know, it was the bath in the evening. And this was kind of when she would sort of be at her most emotional, sort of vulnerable, and you start relaxing. And right. So one day she's in the bathtub there, and she's getting really upset and starting to cry. And I was like, honey, what's the matter? And she said, oh, my friend Isabel. I said, oh, what happened to Isabel? Nothing. Oh, okay. Well, why are you crying? What if she doesn't like me tomorrow?
Oh, God,
did anything? Did anything happen? You know, so trying to parse this out, and nothing had happened. She just had this anxiety. What if? And I just thought, wow, at that age, like my brother and I, we were literally beating our heads against walls to see would it hurt. And this was like,
yeah.
Whereas she's having this whole sort of emotional thing of would people like me? Do they don't like me? Why will they still like me? And I thought, wow, this is at 6. Man, in 10 years, I'm going to be just completely out of my league now. What am I going to do?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I won't even attempt to sort of try and win an argument with either of them. Females are so much more emotionally intelligent and sort of just ninja when it comes to all that landscape. And we're pretty much monkeys, you know?
I'm hooting over here and I'm scratching my armpit, let me tell you.
Yeah.
You
know? Yeah.
So yeah. We had talked before some about, you know, you kind of getting interested in music and your father at times encouraging and other times not as encouraging. And I'd asked you about the girls and you said, well, you know, that just sort of remained to be seen if they would take any interest. So have they taken any interest in doing music stuff?
Not actively as musicians or writers or anything like that. I mean, my eldest one has, I mean, she can hear a rap song one time, sort of a breathless, wordy rap song. And the next time that thing comes on the radio, she's like knows it all. And she's sort of on that level, loves music. She's listening to it all the time and knows all the lyrics of, I mean, it could be a Beatles song or it could be, you know, the latest, you know, Harry Styles song or whatever it is. She knows all the lyrics and the melodies, but she enjoys it more as a listener than, you know, she's not as interested in really going into it, the business or doing that, which is kind of a huge relief, honestly, for me, you know, knowing what it's like in this business and particularly the kind of stuff that, you know, females have had to deal with historically. So I'm not mad at that fact, you know?
Well, let's talk some about yourself growing up. You play drums in the Bayonets, and that was your first instrument. Is that right?
Yeah, that was my first instrument. You know, my dad would fabricate, you know, a lot. He had a sort of a gift for, he wouldn't ruin a good story for a few details, you know, or truths. And early on when I was a kid, he told me he was a drummer, and which in fact he never really was. But so I wanted to be a drummer, obviously, because I idolized my dad like so many, you know, young kids do. And he got me my first drum kit. I remember going to Manny's, you know, on 48th Street and picking out this drum kit. It was kind of the Ringo kit, but it wasn't the Black Oyster Pearl. It was called like Orange Strata, which is more this tiger, like, you know, tiger sort of colors looking.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. And had my first kit, you know, at 8. Set up in an apartment in New York. And the irony, of course, was that by the time my dad would come home at night from the studio, he didn't want to hear music. He didn't want to hear anything. And he certainly didn't want to hear me banging on the drum. So it was challenging to learn and to practice initially. But that's how I started out.
Well, did you have a drum teacher?
I did, man. I had a... I've had a couple teachers over the years. I started out by going around the corner. There's a music school called the Manus College of Music. Mm-hmm. And I went there a little bit. It wasn't that interesting. They only had like, you know, those old rubber practice pads, you know, that we would play, and which really didn't do much for me. And then later on, I had a teacher named Norman Grossman, who I really learned so much for. I learned how to read and learned so many different styles, really where most of my formal education came from. And then I studied for a minute with a great jazz drummer named Freddie Waits for a bit. And I think the last like lesson I ever took, I was probably 16 or 17, I don't know. When did Steely Dan's Home at Last come out on?
That I don't know.
So it was the Purdy Shuffle. And I had one lesson with Bernard Purdy to learn that killer groove that he's famous for, that that Pecara later adapted for Rosanna, and Bonham adapted for, I will forget the name of the tune, had that same kind of groove. But yeah, I learned that groove straight for the halftime Purdy Shuffle, straight from Purdy when I was a teenager. And I think that was like my last lesson. So I did have some formal education. I did learn how to read, and I did study. But really, like most things, and like with my guitar playing, most of it was listening to records and just wearing out the grooves of certain songs that I loved, you know?
And you mentioned there playing guitar. So as I recall, there was something about, you know, you're playing drums and then your father takes your side at some point saying, hey, you know, you can't write songs if you're the drummer.
Yeah. Yeah. Man, you got a good memory. Yeah. You know, my dad pulled me aside at about 12 years old and I guess he was worried that I was going to actually become a drummer based on his, you know, based on his telling me that he was. And
all right.
And I'm not sure what that fear was rooted in. I don't know that I would starve to death or something, or that I wouldn't be good enough. But yeah, he told me, you know, you can't write songs as a drummer, and sort of pushed me in the direction of playing another instrument. And so I picked up guitar at about 12 and was really a closet player, you know, because through high school, I, you know, in college, I really mainly played drums and bands. Mm-hmm. And but was always playing guitar and listening to records and learning stuff, you know, in my room. And it really wasn't until I ended up in Minneapolis in sometime in the 80s, you know, 83, 84, that someone kind of pushed me to audition for a touring gig with Alexander O'Neill, who had just made his first record produced by Terry Lewis and Jimmy Jam Harris. And I very reluctantly went in for this audition as a guitar player, and I got it. And, you know, it was R&B and funk and a lot of that Minneapolis style, Prince
right.
style funk,
yeah.
Which is something that I actually did well because, you know, my roots were in rhythm as a drummer, and
yeah.
Rhythm guitar and that stuff came very naturally to me. And so I kept going through the years, played on, you know, a lot of my own records, and came to L.A. somewhere in the 90s. And one thing led to another, and I auditioned for Rod Stewart as his guitar player, and got the gig, and you know, ended up making a record with him in my studio for about a year,
yeah.
and touring with him for about a year. So, I mean, the irony is that when I think about myself as a musician, I really think of myself more as a drummer. Like if someone said, hey, you want to hop on stage and sit in, I would feel way more comfortable as a drummer somehow. But
yeah.
But my higher profile gigs and most of my playing over the years has been on records and stuff has been as a guitar player.
Well, you know, I wanted to ask you more about getting to Minneapolis in a moment, but one last question about the early on stuff. It seems like you and your brother as well, right, took to rock and roll pretty quickly. And I was just wondering, you know, for a lot of kids, you know, music is a way to rebel or piss your parents off.
Right.
But, I mean, you've got a disadvantage with your father being involved with the music business. Did you piss him off with music, or was it something else?
No, I managed him to piss him off with, you know, with other kinds of rebellious behavior and stuff that I got into in my teens, you know, enough so that I got sent away to a school on a working farm in like on a hill in Vermont, as far away from, you know, he tried to get me as far away from, New York and you know, all of the stuff that I was getting into at the time. So I spent my last years in high school with 85 milking cows on a farm in Vermont.
Well, so you were like really pissed off about that? Or I mean, did you come to appreciate the environment that you were in, or how did you deal with it?
Well, you know, he said he got me to get on the Greyhound bus by telling me that if I didn't like it after 2 weeks, I could come home. And man, 2 weeks to the day came up and I called him and I'm like, man, I've given it a shot. This shit ain't for me. I'm coming home. And in so many words, he said, yeah, no, you're staying. And I don't really have room for, you know, whatever. He basically said no. And I hung up the phone and I hit the wall, whatever wall was in front of me. And I fractured my hand. And so not only did I end up, you know, staying there, but I went through the first couple months with a cast on my hand. And moving forward, I ended up loving it. I actually ended up loving it and making great friends. And I actually think in some ways it really did save me from going down a much darker road, you know? I would later go down a dark road, but I think it was a great stopgap for that time, you know? It slowed me down. It really slowed me down. Unfortunately, it was 2 years though that I really didn't play music. Actually, that's not true. There was one other kid that showed up a year later, the my last year there, my senior year. He was a freshman, and he played guitar, and he would walk around with this Les Paul slung down to his knees with these headphones that I guess were, you know, the cutting edge technology at the time. Right. You could plug these headphones into your guitar and kind of like, you know, hear a distorted sound. And he was walking around like Vermont in the woods with this Les Paul playing. And we ended up, we were really the only two musicians that were into rock and blues and all that stuff. We ended up playing a lot together. And that guy was Reb Beach, who went on to be the guitar player for Winger and all these other huge. He became sort of a 80s guitar shred hero, you know.
Have you managed to keep in contact with him over the years?
It's been a minute now. It's probably been 15 years, but we've run into each other, and I think we had a phone call, and we had a good laugh and a good I remember I for my senior year, I got to you could create a project for your senior year where you went away for a couple months and you did something. Some kids studied abroad and some kids, you know, did various things. And I managed to get them to agree to my going back to New York and doing a recording project where I would write and record three original tunes. And I ended up doing that. I came back. You had to present whatever it is you did to the school at a morning meeting. And I played these three songs that I had written and recorded and produced or whatever. And I remember him mentioning years later when we did reconnect that he said that that really had a profound effect on him and really inspired him to want to kind of just keep going and move ahead. And he was somehow impressed with whatever I had done, although I think I waited to the last like 2 weeks of the period to like sort of knock it out.
Right. But, of course. Yeah.
But yeah, but you know, the odds of the two of us ending up in this school, seem pretty slim, but we both managed to make our way in very different avenues, you know?
Right. Well, you mentioned this, I guess class project, whatever you're involved with, you writing, producing.
Yeah.
So what is it that gets you to Minneapolis, and how does this wind up with you writing and producing a couple number one songs, you know, big songs for Paul?
Yeah.
There's like Opposites Attract, Forever Your Girl.
Yeah.
How did you wind up writing, producing these tunes? And did that come out of being in the going to Minneapolis?
Yeah. Well, so that sort of came out of my my continued sort of, struggle with some habits that I had developed early in my life. You know, I really wrestled with using substances, to be really frank. And I ended up leaving college, and the last year, my senior year, because I couldn't keep up, you know, with the academics. And I went back to New York, and interestingly enough, I mean, I got a gig as a construction worker there, in town, and I had another gig, which was playing drums for and being the MD for David Hodo, who was the construction worker in The Village People.
Oh, wow.
Which was a weird, I was like sort of construction work during the day and then rehearsals with him, at night. It was high contrast living. And, yeah. But I didn't last too long, man. I lasted a few months, and of that spring semester in New York. And by summer, I was really in bad shape. And I got on a plane, and I was headed to this place called Hazelden in Minnesota, mm-hmm. To try and straighten up.
Yeah.
And long story short, I did that. And they recommended that I really stay some extra time in Minnesota and really sort of get my feet firmly planted in sobriety,
Right.
Which I did. And it was 1983. And and there was this guy running around town making a movie called Purple Rain. And
what who that guy was?
Yeah, I don't know. Some guy. There was just this buzz in the air and this music in the air. And, I started sitting in town, playing drums, and got a reputation for being a pretty good, pretty good drummer from New York, and started playing more and sort of got involved in the local scene. And it was through that I met some musicians, and one of those musicians was the guy that urged me to audition as a guitar player for Alexander O'Neill.
Okay.
As a result of that gig, that tour ended up with a big gig at First Avenue, which, as you know, is sort of at this point an iconic club, and
right.
where Prince used to play a lot. And it was the club in Purple Rain. And we had this big gig at First Avenue, and all the Minneapolis royalty came out. It was Terry and Jimmy and Prince and Jesse Johnson, who had been the guitar player in the time. Right. And they were all at the gig, and I played the gig. And I think a few days later, man, my phone rang, and it was Jesse Johnson. And he said, "Hey, I'm putting this band together called Tamara and the Scene. And I want to know if you want to come out and audition." And I was like, "Yeah, sure." And that was, I loved the time, and I idolized Jesse Johnson, loved his guitar playing. I mean, he and Prince for me are the funkiest rhythm guitar players, bar none. And so I went out there and I got the gig with Tamara and the Scene, and we had a record deal on A&M, did one record. And at that point, I was hanging a lot with Jesse, and he would invite me. I loved the blues, and I could play a lot of blues guitar. And he was, he has an encyclopedic knowledge, man, of blues guitar. And he can take you stylistically through the history, playing everything from Delta blues to Chicago blues to all of it. And he can say, "Well, here's the difference, and here's how it evolved." And he... great player, and all the way up to Hendrix and all of it. He's one of my favorite guitar players. And he really became a mentor, and he would call me out at all hours to his studio, like 2 a.m. My phone would ring and be like, "Oliver, is Jesse, come out here." And I would spring out of bed and get in my car, my 76 monkey shit brown Pontiac Le Mans, and drive out to his place and hang out. And I watched him make the records he was making as well at the time. And he had some big hits. One was a collab with Sly Stone. And he was making really hard hitting funk records. And it was, I got inspired by going out there and listening and watching his process. Mm-hmm. And I thought to myself, I don't know, I think I can do that, you know? And I bought a drum machine and I brought a couple keyboards and I started doing these grooves in my bedroom in a house that I shared with five other sober guys in St. Paul.
Yeah.
And, you know, I could be really long winded with, so I don't want to be, but it really was those early grooves that I learned that I really was sort of trying to emulate what Jesse was doing and what Prince right. was doing that turned into those early hits with Paula. And so it was really that influence of being in Minneapolis and really being inundated with the music that Prince was doing and the time and Terry and Jimmy and, you know, like touring with Alexander and playing in this band that Jesse had written and produced, that I really got that style under my belt as a guitar player and just with as a drummer and as, you know, my ears that later I would use as a producer. I really soaked it up and came to really understand it. And I just felt that shit deeply. It was really natural to me, you know? And I well, think know, you, that what, yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, no, I mean, what, go ahead.
What I was going to ask you is, so, you know, you had these episodes where, you know, you're trying to get yourself back together and you're able to focus, you know, with music again.
Yeah.
And then you had, you know, those were really those Paul Abdul songs, really big songs, hits, you know, number one hits even. Did your what was your father's comment on your pop music success? Was it like, oh, well, the apple doesn't fall too far from the tree or
man, do you want to know the truth?
Yeah.
All right. Here's the truth. So for years, man, he would always ask me what I was writing, what was I working on? And as a kid, you know, even like my first song I wrote, I think when I was like 12, you know, or 13 on the guitar and I played it for him. It was called Getting Mugged, which is something that happened to me a lot as a kid growing up in New York in the 70s. That was my first song, Getting Mugged. And, you know, God bless him, man. He didn't have a father and he didn't really understand parenting too much, you know? So he treated me like he would treat any, you know, Carole King or, you know, any of these writers that were sort of part of his stable at the, you know, at the time. And he would just give me honest criticism and feedback. And that's what he always gave me. So, you know, he would criticize mainly. And so after years of that, I honestly like stopped playing him stuff. I just stopped.
Right.
And I remember I had just cut these tracks in Minneapolis for Paula. They hadn't come out yet. And he calls me on the phone. He's like, hey, man, what you working on? What's going on? I said, well, I cut these tracks. It's going to come out on this new artist. And he's like, play me something. And my mind, you know, it's like Lucy and Charlie Brown and the football.
Oh, no.
You know, it's like, he knows better. And he's like, no, I'm not doing that anymore. And she's like, no, this time, I promise you, I'm going to hold the football. And against my better judgment, I'm like, all right, I'm going to play you something. And I played him a track. I think I played him Forever Your Girl, you know? And there's the track ends and there's a little bit of a space that takes a beat. And I'm waiting. He goes, man, that shit sounds Mickey Mouse. And I was like, oh, yeah, well, you know, this one's on me. I should have known better. Now, years later, and, you know, these things became number ones. And I remember being at an ASCAP award and I was getting some award for opposites or whatever, some kind of recognition, and hadn't seen him or talked to him in a couple of years. I think I was probably still, you know, licking my wounds after that.
Right.
And he sees me and he comes up to me, big hug. I'm so proud of you. And, you know, it was hard for me to let in, you know, it was hard for me to let in, but, at that point, I guess since I was, you know, I've been successful, you know, there was a part of him, I guess, that could acknowledge it. And, you know, and said it was great work. So, you know, who knows? I heard a lot third hand, really, that he was proud of me and really loved what I was doing. I never heard it too much firsthand from him, to be really honest, you know?
I think that's the thing too. It's like he, you know, when the type of, it's just also a styles move on, and you know, we all have our own perspectives and perceptions of what is good and what is not good. And when you're playing those tracks, I mean, to him, that's Mickey Mouse. That's not, and it's like, well, you know, your ears aren't listening to what's going on right now, and you're in a different place, you know, because I mean. Like they were doing stuff, him and Stoller, right? There's Is that All There Is? And then like they did that for Peggy Lee or something. I mean, they had sort of moved on from these roots that, you know, he, I'm sure, loved until his dying day. But they moved on to sort of a different realm with their creativity, yeah, I mean, what they were focusing on. So, yeah.
Well, you know, to be fair to him too, you know, I had done three tracks. I happened to play him the poppiest one because that's what I had sort of locked and loaded in my cassette player at the time.
Yeah.
But when he heard the track to It's Just the Way That You Love Me, which I think ended up at number three or number two on the charts.
Yeah.
He fell out. I mean, that was a way more R&B funky track. And he actually, before I cut that on Paula, took that to Russ Titelman, played it for him, and I got a call from Russ Titelman asking me if I wanted to co-produce it with him for Shaka. Yeah, and I ended up, believe it or not, passing on that and recording it on Paula. Very counterintuitive move, right?
Yeah.
But all that to say, that when he did hear something he liked, and when I was doing stuff that was funkier and more rooted in R&B and you know, and that sort of thing, he heard it, and that's just where he lived. That's what moved him, you know. So he did respond, but you know, Forever Your Girl was just a little too, you know, sugar for him.
Well, what gets you from Minneapolis out to LA? Because I know you come out to Los Angeles, you wind up with some cover band with our very own Michael DeBar, and like he was in that band as well. I want to find out how you guys actually met, but what gets you from Minneapolis out to Los Angeles and starting to like playing a cover band with Michael DeBar?
Two words: Sheena Easton. You know, I had had some success with Paula, and all of a sudden my phone was ringing and I was getting asked to write and produce for primarily female, you know, pop R&B artists. And I was writing and producing for Sheena Easton. She was sort of jumping back and forth between Paisley Park and working with Prince.
Yeah.
And by that point, I had bought a house pretty close to Paisley and had a 24 track set up in my living room. And I was working with her, and one thing led to another. And over the course of the process of writing and recording and mixing these records, we started dating. And and at one point, I think maybe after about a year of her flying back and forth and me flying back and forth, she sort of said, you know, if you're serious about me, you'll come move to LA. And I think I bought a house in a day and a half. I flew here. Wow. The first house I saw, she looked at it with me. I was in my 20s. I didn't really know. And frankly, at that point, I think I was, I just wanted to make her happy, and I wanted to make it happen. So I bought the first house and ended up moving out here. And we lasted about another 7 minutes, you know, once I moved out here.
Oh, okay.
But that's how I ended up here. you know, after 8 years in Minneapolis. It was the start of a new chapter.
Well, what hooks you up with, so now you're back to playing, you're playing primarily drums, like when you're with DeBar, was that with drums?
No. That was, Michael and I were friends. We had friends in common. We had met sometime, you know, early 90s, you know, and I was kicking around LA and playing here and there. And we were talking one day and he's like, man, you want to do a band? And I'm like, sure, I'd love to. What do you want to do? He said, you know, let's play just classic rock and roll, you know. And he's got that, as you know, that killer voice. Right. You know, he's got that great, English, blue-eyed, you know, gravelly rock and roll voice. And he said, let's do some classic stuff. And he said, there's this other guitar player, Brian Ray, and he's great, and he's kicking around too. We should call him, you know? And I had never heard Brian. I think I'd met him maybe a couple times and been introduced. He'd been introduced as a guitar player, but I really didn't know his history, and I didn't know what he had done. I didn't know about Etta James or any of that, you know. And
let's point that out too. That you mentioned Etta James. That Brian was Etta James's music director for a while in her band.
Yeah, at a really young age, man. I think he was like 17, 18. This long-haired, sort of, you know, skinny, classic sort of rock, 70s rock and roll kind of, you know, looking kid. And he was the MD for Etta James, man, which I learned later on, you know, gave him instant credibility in my eyes, you know?
Yeah.
And yeah. So he was also had that sort of, had roots in blues and R&B and stuff as well. We also had that in common, you know? And so, yeah, we said, hey, let's do it. And we just sort of got in the room. You know, I had come off the Rod tour, so I had a lot of those songs in my head and under my belt, and they seemed perfect for Michael. So we threw probably 4 or 5 Rod Stewart songs in there. And then we just kind of started picking our favorite stuff, you know, Mississippi Queen and All Right Now and Rock and Roll Hoochie Coo and just all that great rock and roll though that has a pocket and a groove, you know?
Yeah.
And Brian pulled in a friend of his, Scott Schreiner, on bass, who ended up probably within a week or two of each other. Brian got the McCartney gig and Scott Schreiner got the Weezer gig.
Okay.
Which was unbelievable and life-changing for both of them.
Yeah.
But so we kicked around and did a bunch of gigs in LA as a band called Down Boy. Mm-hmm. And that was our that's how we met. That's how we originally connected. And you know, after that, Brian would call me. I remember he called me. I think he was working on his first solo project. And he obviously knew my history as a songwriter and producer. And I think he asked me to write, like, would I help him with a couple songs?
Yeah.
On that first record. And I will be hard pressed to remember the titles now. But we got together and I helped him lyric a couple of them. And I think that was our first writing collab, you know?
Okay.
And that evolved eventually to, I guess, you know, our deciding some years later to write together, you know, as the Bayonets.
And as the Bayonets, I mean, you conceived that initially just as yourself and him, or were there other players?
Yeah, you know, that came about, there was a time, I'm going to say it was 2013 or 2014. I think he had a minute off the road and was back in LA. And my father had just passed away.
Oh.
And his brother had passed away, and relatively, you know, within, you know, close proximity of each, not proximity, but, you know, in terms of time frame, really right. close to each other. And we were hanging out at my house here in the backyard, and we were talking about, you know, we were talking about that. We were both kind of in, I don't know, kind of in a just a low period. We were really feeling it. We were feeling the grief from that. And somewhere in that conversation, I don't know who brought it up, but he's like, hey, you know, we should write some stuff together. And I remember saying, okay, you know, and we had done the thing where I wrote for him, you know, and his solo yeah. projects. And I think he had maybe by then put a couple records out. Yeah. And I was thinking, all right, let's do a band. You know, you want to do a band? He's like, okay. And it started from there. And he had met Lucretia in Argentina, I think playing a few gigs as, you know, Brian Ray as a solo artist.
Yeah.
He had played there and he had used a band there.
And let me interrupt for a second, because sure. we're talking yeah. about Lucretia Lopez Sanz.
Sure.
Yes. And she's on the bunch of different bandits recording. She's on the new single as well. So go on. She you guys met her or rather Brian was familiar with her from.
Yeah. Brian had met her because he used a band that she was in, which was a Beatles cover band back in Argentina. He had used them as his backup band for some solo gigs mm-hmm. in some clubs. And when we were talking about doing a band, we were looking at each other. I don't know who it was that said it. Maybe it was me. I'm like, look at, you know, so we're a couple of old dudes. We need some eye candy, man. We need some youth. We need some, you know, we need something to add some flavor to this party. And he was like, you know what? I know this girl back in Argentina that I met, and she plays guitar and she sings and she's great looking and she's got a vibe. And he said, what do you think about that? I'm like, I'm in, you know, that sounds great. And so that's how the concept of the three of us really as the nucleus of the band came about. And so Brian said about, and you know, I said about writing, but we would write with her as a, you know, always in mind as a part of the, you know, the construct of the band and the songs, and would always, you know, in a lot of the songs, think in terms of the interplay between Brian as a character, as a male, you know, and Lucretia as a, you know, as the female counterpart. And so she was always kind of baked into the DNA of the songwriting that we did.
Well, let's talk then about the new single, because it's called Argentina.
Right.
Been out a week now on Wicked Cool Records. It's this week's coolest song in the world. Tell me about, I mean, she's from Argentina. You know, listen to the lyrics there. I mean, is she directly the inspiration for that, or is it?
Well, I would say she is definitely a part of it, because I think, you know, in that moment when we had these chords and we kind of had this melody, right? You know, right? That kind of four note sort of melody. I was a chorus idea. You know, she's in the room with us. She's part of that. You know, she's there with us as far as being a member of the band and thinking about, you know, how we write. And she's from Argentina. So, you know, I think that was definitely part of the inspiration. And, you know, just, you know, how you throw these ideas against the wall until something sticks, man. And I don't know, it just hit me and I just threw that out and started singing Argentina. And that in turn led to, you know, this story that we created. But you know, I wouldn't say that the story per se is about anyone in particular, but the inspiration of a girl in Argentina, you know, there's no denying that Lucretia, you know, played a role in that, and as part of the band, and just being in our consciousness, you know.
Well, we're going to talk about the B side of the single in a moment, but so you've done Argentina, and you did this the B side post Apocalypso. Did you have you recorded more songs than just the single?
No, that we just did. We just did those two songs at the time. You know, Brian called me up, and it'd been a quite some time, a couple of years, I think, since we did. Well, Christmas Time is Cruel was the last thing we had cut together.
Yeah, that was 2015. Well, that's 2015 when we spoke, right? Yeah. That was on the Christmas Day and everything. And that's the we were playing that tune as, you know, in the holiday season, there's a lot of we play a lot of Christmas songs. And so Stephen had picked that as the coolest song of the week for that particular week of the holidays.
Right. So we hadn't really collaborated since then. And he called me up and he said, "Hey, man, you want to write some Bayonet stuff, a couple songs?" And I was like, "Absolutely, let's do it." And so we just sort of wrote those songs with the idea, you know, of course, the hopeful, wishful idea that we might come up with something that would be cool enough to, you know, maybe get us on the radio again.
Well, bullseye, was really, buddy.
Yeah, you know, God, how lucky are we?
So did you record it over at? I mean, I'm assuming you have a home studio. Did you do it over there or at Brian's place?
Yeah. Well, we for the all of the main band tracking, because we cut these things live, you know. Yeah. All of the main band tracking is done at my place, because I have a big studio here, like 2,300 square foot studio with this great Neve 8068 board and big drum room and multiple rooms. So it really lends itself to cutting live. So for the most part, our stuff is cut here. And then on some songs, not all of them, but on some songs, Brian likes to go back to his place and cut vocals. At times we've done it both ways, but he likes to go back to his place, cut vocals, and then guitar overdubs. You know, after we have a picture of the track, he'll hear some extra stuff and want to do guitar overdubs, and he'll do that at his place sometimes too. So I think Argentina was a combo platter. And then of course there's always the task of getting Lucretia and her vocals on the tracks. And that involves sending her the tracks and getting her in a studio somewhere in Argentina and getting on Zoom or FaceTime and somehow having access to her where we can, you know, produce her vocals and help her with that. So it's usually like, you know, a threefold process.
And so she's in Argentina right now.
Yeah, she's in Argentina now.
Mm-hmm. So are you guys thinking of getting her stateside and trying to do any shows or not? Or is that just too difficult now?
You know, that's something that we haven't discussed, you know, I would think that if our schedules aligned, you know, Brian's been a very busy guy, as you know, for you know, with this killer side gig he's had for all these years now. And you know, it's about logistics. I think we would all love to do it, and it would be really fun to get together again. You know, we did it once and we've done some live gigs and shows. It would be great to do it again. I'm sure all of us would love to if the stars align, you know. I wouldn't take that off the table, but we haven't discussed that yet, you know. We've discussed the possibility down the line of getting in the studio and doing some more writing though. So, you know, remains to be seen.
Well, let's focus here on the B side, Post Apocalypso. Then we'll give it a listen. You described before how sometimes you guys, will write songs and it's pretty easy breezy, kind of falls in place. And other times there's a lot of head butting. Well, which category does this one fall into?
Okay, so I'm trying to think back. We had this track in a really rough form. I think it was bass, drums, and guitar. We had this basic track in the can, but we had an idea that we never really completed on it, and it wasn't on the record, you know, the first record we right. put out.
Crash, boom, bang.
Crash, boom, bang. Yeah. But it was sitting there as this undeveloped idea, or whatever the idea was, we weren't completely sold on it. So I was in a music store and I was noodling on a guitar, and this other guy's noodling on a bass, and we start to talk, and you know, he tells me that he was that he was in a band called Canned Heat. I'm like, you're kidding, man, that's so cool. I'm forgetting his name, but they called him the Mole. And I remember around that time I came back and I said, man, Brian, I ran into the Mole. And Brian knew who he was right away from Canned Heat. And so we just thought it would be great, since we kind of used a few different bass players on the tracks. We had Scott play, we had, you know, Davey Farragher play. That was sort of an open slot in our recording process, you know?
Yeah.
He said, we got to get the Mole on something, man. We got to get him. So he had played on that track. He had played upright bass, and the track that became Post-Apocalypso. So we revisited it, you know, after we wrote Argentina, we revisited it. And now we're like in the middle of the pandemic, you know?
Yeah.
And it's got that feel. It's got that, you know, I don't know if it's technically a calypso or if it's a bayon or if it's a, but it's got that feel to it. And Brian had thrown out an idea. I think, you know, we were talking about that we were living in this apocalypse, and I can't remember the exact sequence, but he might have said something like, you know, the apocalyptic calypso or something. And I think I was driving around after that, and I just sort of mashed up the two. And I thought it might be clever to call it the post-apocalypso.
It is clever. Yeah, it works well. Yeah.
We've always been good like that, because, you know, we both come up with ideas, and yeah, we will butt heads, but we both recognize when the other guy's kind of, you know, got a good idea. And so we landed on that, and the rest, kind of flowed from that. And we were sort of feeling like we were living at a time when, you know, the world was burning, man. And it was really an apocalyptic time. A lot of people, you know, were feeling that. And we thought that it would be a little tongue in cheek, and sort of, you know, trying to take the humorous side, if you will, of just being in such dark times, you know. And, you know, in some ways, I've always consciously or unconsciously borrowed from my father. He's never far away from my consciousness. Uh-huh. And I think that idea and that line from Is That All There Is, which you referenced, of, if that's all there is, my friends, let's break out the booze and let's keep dancing. Let's have a ball if that's all there is. And I think that's kind of what inspired some of the lyrics too, which is that, man, if the plane's going down, let's go down dancing, you know, let's go down, that idea. Let's go down in celebration of humanity and what's joyful. So I think that's kind of, those are the elements that came together on that song.
Yeah. Man, Oliver, thanks so much again for speaking with me today on our Coolest Conversations.
It's my pleasure. It's absolutely my pleasure, man. And I hope we get to do it again sometime, you know?
Oh, yeah. You guys keep calling each other up, keep working together. For sure, it's going to happen again. And now,
absolutely.
Now we're going to take a listen to the new singles, B-side, Here's a band that's doing post-apocalypso in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
When I was young, they said the sun would last a billion years. The earth, the moon, the stars above could never disappear. And now we find that all mankind is just in love with war and complete annihilation.
We just heard a bit of Apocalypso from the Bayonets here in Little Steven's Underground Garage. It's a B-side of their latest single, Argentina, and available from Wicked Cool Records. This is the Mighty Manfred, and thanks again to band member Oliver Lieber for speaking with me today. Thanks also to Sammy Semenza for producing our podcast. The Now are a UK band from South Wales, and we featured their debut EP last year here in the Underground Garage. Well, they've got a brand new single out now called Devil Inside Me. And I'll be speaking with band member Will Scott all about it on your next Coolest Conversations podcast presented by Hard Rock in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
Buddy, you're a boy. Make a big noise playing in the street. I'm gonna be a big man someday. You got mud on your face, you big disgrace. Kicking your can all over the place.
Some things are better when they rock. The Seminole Hard Rock Hotels and Casinos rock around the clock with nonstop casino action, rooms fit for the king, pools, spas, restaurants, and clubs for every taste and temptation. Seminole Hard Rock Hotel and Casino in Tampa or Hollywood, Florida. We will rock you.